Shalom, I am Alan.
And I am Leontine. Alan and I are professional tour guides, friends, and immigrants to Israel. In this podcast, we talk about everything Israel and our life here.
I moved to Israel, fulfilling a lifelong dream after 30 years as a trial lawyer in Memphis, Tennessee. And I have a lot to say about my homeland.
And I was born in Holland, then lived and worked as a licensed tour guide in France, and ended my journey living and working in Israel.
Yalla, let's go!
Alan, how are you today?
Hi, Leontine. I'm great. Shavua Tov.
A good week to you, Alan. So, by the way, a good week. How was your week?
Another great week. You know, Diane and I walk our dogs, Louie and Daisy, every morning. And our route is going to Gan Soccer, to Soccer Park, which is right below the Knesset in Jerusalem, a beautiful park. And I don't know. Have you seen the new
it's playground?
Yes. You call it a playground. I call it an adventure park.
Totally. I'm dying to bring my grandchildren to this park, but it looks like it's made for adults actually because it's so high. They go so high.
It is freaking insane.
Yeah.
Okay. And this isn't a public park, no admission, and you go into this adventure park with slides that are 50 feet high.
Yeah.
I mean, it's incredible. And they have rope jungles and climbing and that are also suspended above the ground.
And you can even play your DJ. They have this installation.
Yeah. Hey, Mr. DJ, put a record on. And they have, what do you call it? Omega is what they call it here.
Yes, the pulley. Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
I mean, it's absolutely insane.
Yeah.
To see what is open to the public and to people of all ages, you would never have that in the United States.
No, because as soon as somebody falls, they would sue the
right. You'd have to first that would have to be inside of a park that you pay money for, and then you sign off a release and waiver.
Yes.
Releasing them
crazy
of any responsibility.
Crazy Americans.
But it is crazy. And I when I walked there this morning, I just said, boy, I cannot wait to bring Levana.
Yes. And then she will go up 30 meters and then you'll be freaking out. Or you'll have to go with her, actually.
Not on your life.
So, do you want to know about my week?
I do.
So, my week was good. I did a cycling tour, actually. I cycled, you know, Dutch people like to bicycle. So, I did a tour of Tel Aviv and they wanted to do it on the bicycle. So, we did.
An electric bike?
No. I mean, now more and more there are electric bikes in Holland. But if you're a real Dutch person, you don't do electric. Anyway, you don't need it in Tel Aviv because it's all flat. Here in Jerusalem, I would not do it non-electric. I would not do a tour or by bike anyway in Jerusalem because it's not yet. They're getting there, but it's not yet completely adapted for cycling. But Tel Aviv is great. You have bicycle paths everywhere. And it's very nice because you can, in a very relaxed way, cover all of the city. You can really visit all of Tel Aviv on a bicycle without being in a hurry. And you know, it's warm, you have the sun, there is wind, so it's very pleasant to cycle.
Was this an organized bike?
No. These were private clients. They wanted to do two people. They wanted to do a bicycle tour of Tel Aviv. So we went to a place where they rent out bicycles. We rented three bicycles, one for me, two for them. And off we went. And we had the bikes for the whole day.
What a great
yeah.
day.
Yeah. Wow. It was very nice. And they give you locks. And so you can lock it and start. You know, when we went into Jaffa, we walked. And then we took the bicycles. We went somewhere else. We locked them. And no,
but you're
very
always
nice.
Complaining about the heat in Tel Aviv. It wasn't too hot?
Yes, it's always too hot in Tel Aviv. But I only complain when I'm with you. Not when I'm with tourists. So I dealt with it. So that was my week. Very nice. On the bicycle, always good. So we are sitting here, as usual, in the Brown Hotel. They're very, very good to us, spoiling us. And my eye fell, because we're in the bar of the Brown Hanevim Hotel, and my eyes fell on a bottle that says Akko. And Akko is a city northwest of Jerusalem by the sea.
We're going to have to talk about Akko.
We will.
Yes.
And it turns out there is a djinn that is called Akko.
Djinn, for people that can't understand her accent, djinn, like the liqueur, the liquor, djinn.
Oh, how do you say it in the States? Djinn.
It's your accent. It's okay.
Djinn. This gin is I tasted it, so that's why I'm a bit happy. It's really, really good. It's handmade from 12 wild and rare plants foraged from the Galilee region and carefully distilled in small hatches. Wild gin of the Galilee. So that was my little, I don't know this company, but I made a little free publicity for you. Oops. Oh, sorry. That was no, that was false. That was fake.
Enough
that
gin for you.
Yes. So from gin, the step is not too far to go to the Crusaders and to Chastelet.
The topic of the day.
Absolutely.
Chastelet.
So do you remember when we discovered Chastelet for the first time during the tour guide course?
I remember Chastelet. I remember going there. I think I've only been back once, maybe twice. I did go because sometimes it's along the route. But yes, I remember going there. Was there something particular that happened that I should remember that I'm not remembering?
No. It's just it made a huge impression on me because in general, I love everything that has to do with the Crusaders.
Yes, you're Crusader-centric.
My weak points of Leontine. So the story of Chastelet is like all the stories here is amazing. And that's the story we're going to tell you. So Chastelet, first of all, is a French word and it means a small castle. So it is located exactly at a crossing at the Jordan River. So the Jordan River runs from the north to the south, east of Jerusalem. And it was at a crossing where a road was going from Akko, which we just talked about, an important harbor city in the time of the Crusaders, towards Damascus. So it was a trade road. So it was very important. And you needed at one point to cross the Jordan. And at this point, it was easy to cross. So what did the Crusaders? They arrived here in 1099. They conquered Jerusalem and then the rest of the country. And then they started to build strong points, so fortresses in strategic places, so they could hold the places, but they could also ask for taxes. And that's what they did here in violation with the agreements that they had with the Ayyubid, with the Muslims from Damascus. They built a fortress at the crossing of the Jordan, which was, again, against the agreements that they had. Because this passage going from Damascus to Akko was a passage for everybody. And the idea was that everybody could cross to make business. And the Crusaders and the Ayyubids were, at certain moments in the year, they were in war. And other moments, they were not, and they were working.
So basically, the Crusaders and the Ayyubids, or the Muslims, the Crusaders and the Muslims were getting along relatively well. They had peace treaties and agreements, and they were abiding by them until the Crusaders decided to take over this spot and control this road, which I think was it Baldwin?
The one who had leprosy.
Yeah,
yes.
The leprosy king.
Yes.
So Baldwin decides to, against the treaty that he signed with the Ayyubid ruler at that time was Saladin,
mm-hmm.
And he decided to build this castle anyway, and pissed off Saladin. I mean,
boy, did he piss him off? Yeah. Yes, he pissed him off absolutely. So they continued. Actually, Saladin sent messengers saying, "Okay, you have to stop. This goes against our agreement." But the Crusaders, they didn't care. They just continued building. So that was not a good ending. Eh? What happened in the end? Do you remember? Saladin was very, very annoyed and he decided to go there with an army. Now, the problem is that by the time they realized that an army was arriving, Baldwin and his soldiers were in Tiberias, which was like half a day travel from Chastelet, and they arrived there a little bit late. So when they arrived, the Arabs, the Muslims were already in place. A big battle, and in fact, the Crusaders, they lost.
Yes. They lost the this fortress that they built that was brand spanking new. I think it was less than a year old, wasn't
it? Yeah, it was not completely finished even.
Which is kind of why it's good to go visit, because you can see, you know, a relatively, it's not intact, but it was new.
It was new.
And the I love going there because of the location.
Yes.
You know, it's at the foothills of the Golan Heights. You know that road when you're coming, when I'm coming down that road with tourists, I'm always worried they're going to get car sick, because it's a very winding road coming down, and then a winding road crossing over the Jordan River and up. But it's a beautiful area that was created. Is that Chorazin Heights? That's part of the Chorazin Heights. It's part of the plateau that was built by the basalt, the volcanic,
the cork, they call it cork. Also.
Yeah.
It's a little bit north. Yes. So the why I like to go there is that's first of all, as we all know now, I love everything that's Crusader. The second thing is that there was actually shortly after the battle took place and the Crusaders were beaten by the Ayyubids, there was an earthquake. And that earthquake cracked the building into two. And as the foundation of the building is still standing there, when you go there, you can see the crack, huge crack in the building from top to bottom, that was created by this earthquake. What we also know, archaeologists, they found the bodies of the Crusaders that were murdered during the battle. There were, I think, 600 or 700 that were killed. It was a big battle. And we know that the bodies remained there, and some of the bodies fell into the pits where they kept the drinking water. So then people, you know, the Ayyubids that were around drinking the water, they all became sick and died as well. And the archaeologists actually found the skeletons, the remains of all these dead people there. So it really goes, we know about the story, and when the archaeologists were digging, they found it.
So you can tell some really good ghost stories.
Exactly, like, ooh, really scary. Now, there's not only the fortress there, it's called actually the bridge of the sisters or the daughters of Jacob.
It's Bnei Yaakov, the bridge of Bnei Yaakov, the daughters of Yaakov, which is very, very strange, because Yaakov only had one daughter. You know, Jacob is the father of the 12 tribes of Israel. So he had 12 sons and he had only one daughter. So Jacob didn't have daughters. He only had sons plus one daughter. And B, Jacob lived in the area of Hebron and sometimes settled and had activity in the area of Nablus, which is ancient biblical Shechem. So I don't know that he was ever there with his daughter Dinah. But that's funny. Why you know, as our head of our course used to say, why ruin a good story with facts?
Right. So there are several explanations, but one of them is that there was in Akko a convent with sisters, and they were the sisters of Saint James. And James in French is Jacob. And so the fortress that they built there was to guard the crossing of the river, but also to ask money, or not ask, tell people to pay when they wanted to cross. And the money would go to the convent. So that is maybe why they called it the bridge of the daughters of Jacob, or sisters of Jacob, if it is really for the sisters of the convent. There are actually two bridges there. One bridge that you cross, and another one that was a military bridge, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I want to go back to the Jacob thing, because now I'm actually thinking about it, because the area is called the Ford of Jacob, the area of the crossing, not just the bridge. And we actually do have a story of Jacob being in the area, because Jacob goes off to find a bride, and he's tricked into marrying Leah. And then he works another 7 years to earn the right to marry his first choice, which is Rachel. And after he works for Rachel and Leah's father, Laban, he eventually buys his freedom to come back to the land of Israel, back to Canaan. I think this is the right story. And he's coming, and he's fearful of seeing his brother Esau, who he stole the birthright from. So on his way back from the east, he crosses over the Jordan River when he meets for the first time after many years his brother that he's expecting to not to be such a great reunion. And his brother Esau will actually bow down to Jacob, and they embrace each other somewhere in that area. So perhaps that's the reason why it's called the Ford of Jacob.
Yeah, why not? Who knows? Now, if you want to eat something there, that's also possible, because right after the bridge on the western side of the river is always a Druze man sitting with his little car, and he's selling Druze sandwiches and labanay. Do you see where he is sitting?
I've never noticed him because I'm always worried about those twists and turns and my clients.
Don't worry.
Vomiting.
When you come down from the Golan Heights, from the east,
yes,
yeah, you cross the bridge almost immediately on the right. Always.
It's like a food
truck. There's this guy with a, you know, Druze. You recognize him because they have this very big white kippah on and a beautiful mustache. And he sits there and sells really good sandwiches, actually. And also labanay, which is the local cheese, like cream cheese, and drinks. So you can actually make a little stop there. And then with your sandwich, you can go and visit the fortress and look at the bridge. It has always been a very strategic place. So once there was a bridge that was blown up in 1946, I think.
Is that the Night of the Bridges?
Maybe. And then another time there was a bridge also blown up, I think in 1948 or something like that. So it's been a very strategic place even in modern history.
Well, I want to go back. You mentioned that the crack in the wall.
Yes.
And the two times that I've stopped there, I use it as an example of showing the shifting plates.
Yes.
Because when you're actually on the Jordan River, the Jordan River is the geographical border between Jordan and Israel, and it's also the actual border with the treaty we reached with Jordan in 1994. And the Jordan River, which flows north-south, along a valley that we call the African Syrian Rift Valley, because it's the divide between the two continents of Asia and Africa. And the shifting plates, the shifting tectonic plates of the Asian plate and the African plate, we now have evidence that the Asian plate is shifting in those earthquakes to the north, and the western side of the Jordan River, which is Israel and Egypt on the African plate, is shifting to the south. Do you remember the two places? One is this Chastelet, because where you see the crack, you can actually see that over the many, many years, the crack has been shifting. One side has been shifting to the north and the other side has been shifting to the south.
Yes.
Do you remember that?
Yes.
And
yes.
Where's the other place you can show people evidence of the shifting plates?
I forgot. I know it's also south.
More south. One of our classmates was riding on a pillar with a rock.
Ah, in Beit She'an.
Beit She'an. Yes, got it. That's all I had to say. I'm not going to. He who shall not be named.
No.
but there are two Roman Decapolis cities that were built along the eastern edge of the Roman Empire, which is here in Israel and in Jordan. Beit She'an is on the African side, on the Israel side, and Jerash is on the eastern side or the Jordanian side, two Decapolis Roman cities that had lots of pillars and columns. And all of the pillars in the earthquake of 749 that destroyed those two cities, the ones on the western side, on the Israeli side of the tectonic plate, fell to the north because it was shifting to the south.
Right.
And at Jerash, you see that all of the pillars and columns and things fell to the south because they're shifting north.
Exactly. It's amazing. When you walk in Beit She'an, you walk through the former streets, you can see all the huge columns that are all on the ground, all in the same direction. It's an amazing place. Yes.
Yeah, but the Shasta Lay is like seeing if your house, if one side of it was on the plate, on the eastern plate, and one was on the western plate, and your house would be shifting, splitting in half, and half of it would be shifting to the north and half of it to the south. That's what it's like looking at that wall in Shasta Lay.
Very true. And a kind of a nightmare. So, yeah, so that's, it's a really interesting place. Anyway, visiting the north of Israel, we'll talk about the south another time, but visiting the north of Israel, there's so much to see. And by the way, very close to Shasta Lay, you also have a settlement that doesn't exist anymore, where an important battle took place in 48 between Syrian army and Israeli army. But we'll talk about that another time. Now we are going to go to our question, which is about Masada. So Masada and the Dead Sea area, when you go there, and we talked about En Gedi last week, it's all in the same area and going to float in the Dead Sea. When you go there, is asking a tourist who was here a couple of weeks ago only, and he was amazed that in this amazing, beautiful, important touristic area, there is no place to eat anywhere. He said, I was taken to like a kind of a fast food, not so great, quite expensive. How come and where, if I come back, where should I go?
That questionnaire, the person that asked the question must have been on one of my tours, because I always say there is absolutely no place to stop that's decent to have a meal. When you're visiting the Dead Sea, Masada, En Gedi, and the Judean desert sites along the Dead Sea. And I really don't know why. I mean, it's a question I can't answer. There's really only three or four places that you can stop that are cafeteria style. You can stop at En Gedi. Mm-hmm. The kibbutz has a little cafe there. Or you can even eat in their kibbutz cafeteria. I think you talked about that in one of our previous podcast episodes.
Yeah, the food is not that great, but it's a nice experience because you're eating among the people living in the kibbutz.
But there really are no great options. And I don't understand it, because you could argue that there's, it's not high traffic area. That's for sure. There aren't many people driving along Road 90, which is the road along the western shore of the Dead Sea. But there's certainly a lot of tourists. I mean, the number one site to visit in Israel is the Western Wall, but number two is Masada. Everybody goes to Masada.
Yeah.
So I don't know, listener, why they don't have good restaurants along that road. Do you have any idea?
No. So I think it's, unfortunately for this time, we have no answer for you. We agree with you. Now, we there is one small possibility. I read about a Bedouin that is ready to prepare food for groups. So if you come as an individual tourist, he or she, it's a woman actually, she won't prepare just for two people. But that apparently is pretty good, very fresh and delicious. But otherwise, no. I always encourage people to go for the kibbutz experience, because you get the kibbutz experience, which you don't get every day. And it's a buffet, so you always get something, you always find something that you like. So for me, that would be the best solution.
I've actually started bringing picnic. We go to Machane Yehuda, Shuk Machane Yehuda, when we're in Jerusalem, and we'll buy things for a picnic to have at the picnic tables, either at Masada or at En Gedi, or at the Dead Sea when you're going for your float. So that's also an option.
But you bring a cooler, because
yes,
it's very hot there.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So, listener, I hope we answered a little bit. And guys, we will speak again together next week. Thank you for listening to Yalla Israel. As always, send your questions by email at yalaisraelpodcast@gmail.com or on Instagram at yalaisraelpodcast. This podcast was made possible with the help of Leah Kramer, our editor, Elliot Musses, our musician, and Shai Aloni, our cover art designer.